Yes, LeQuinn's right. It's kind of a lonely, fragmented existence working on these kinds of problems. I apologize. This looks a bit better on my computer than on this computer, but we'll have to go with it. It's a bit grainy. So I guess I want to talk about a couple of issues in this measurement error type of problem. But just as a bit of background. The sort of textbook discussion of measurement error goes something like this. You're interested in some regression relationship between an X and a Y, maybe given some other covariates as well. But for whatever reason, the X is hard to measure well, so you don't get X. You don't see X. You see some surrogate or noisy version of X. You see W instead. And that's bad news in a sense, even if you have nice properties like W is unbiased for X, so that W is really just X plus noise, you get the following sort of picture, that if you did get to see Y and X, those are the blue points, you get one regression line. If you add a lot of noise to those X values, so instead now we've got Y and W as the red points, you tend to see a flattened line. So this is the attenuation or bias toward the null that people talk about with measurement error. So something has to be done. You want to fix that problem. You want to adjust for it. Well, here's one modeling strategy, somewhat generically stated. If we're willing to commit to models for everything at play here, if we're willing to write down a model for the measurement error structure or process, if you like, for the noisy surrogate W, given the X and perhaps given the Y and S as well, if you're willing to commit to a parametric form for the response model, that's the regular old regression relationship you're interested in, maybe Y is a disease outcome, X is some sort of exposure, S is other things you're adjusting for, and if you're willing to also write down a model for the exposure itself, for the X, given whatever other covariates are floating around, then you're in business in the sense that you can take these, you factorize the joint distribution of the WYX here given the S. You can glue these pieces together. If you're Bayesian in persuasion, you can turn the MCMC crank, particularly bearing in mind, of course, there'll be parameters in all these models, right? There'll be a theta sub M in the measurement model, a theta sub R in the response model, and so on. You can turn the MCMC crank over the parameters, for the joint distribution of the parameters and the unobserved X values, given the things that you do get to observe, the W, the Y, and the S. Well, that's maybe conceptually easy and maybe technically difficult, but above and beyond that, there are, I think, many issues lurking here, but two that seem to be front and center is, first off, how parametric do you want to be, or would you be willing to be with these various models here? And I'll spend a few minutes talking about that, not very long. But the issue that I've been more interested in lately, and we'll spend most of today's talk focused on, is simply an issue of identifiability. How many strong assumptions are going to go into these models so that you've got identifiability at the end of the day, that you really can learn these parameters in these three models, given that you don't get to see the X, right? The X is unobserved. You only get to see the W, the Y, and the S. So that's the format. We'll talk a little bit about this, and then more about this. But I guess the other thing I should say is that what's the title of this workshop? Incomplete longitudinal data. Incomplete, yes, lots of incompleteness here, right? You don't get to see the X. Longitudinal, well, I'm not going to say anything particularly about longitudinal data today, but I'll waffle a little bit. First off, there's something of a historical merger here, and there were several proposals that came together to make this workshop, and the measurement error proposal actually had nothing to do with longitudinal data in the first place. But I guess the longitudinal guys won out when it came to naming the workshop. But more seriously, in some sense, these issues are orthogonal. That is, issues of dealing with longitudinal structure in data and issues of dealing with measurement error are to some extent orthogonal, and on the Bayesian side anyway, by and large, techniques that you're going to use in non-longitudinal settings could also be plugged into longitudinal settings, and I have an example of that in my book, for instance. So that's my sort of apology, provided there's nothing more longitudinal in the rest of my talk. I guess the workshop on incomplete and or longitudinal data doesn't have quite the same ring, right? Okay, so this issue of how parametric you might want to be or be willing to be, well, there's sort of a history here, I guess, and in particular, there's this delineation in the literature between so-called functional methods and structural methods. And basically, the so-called functional methods are trying to avoid using a model for the exposure in particular. So I had that, the last of those three models on the earlier slide was a model for the unobserved X variable given other covariates. And some people would like to avoid that entirely, which maybe you can do with some data structures, as opposed to having a model, so-called structural methods, which do use such a model. And there's always this big emphasis in the literature that we can't possibly have a model for the exposure because we don't get to see the exposure, we can't validate the model, which is true to some extent. But the funny thing is that that X variable, the thing you don't get to see, is also sitting around in the other two models as well, and nobody really says you can't have models there. So it's kind of a funny thing that goes on in that's argued in the literature. And moreover, in some cases, you can show, especially if everything's nice and normal and linear, so that's what the ends are here are for, normal models at the three stages we had earlier, then in fact you can show that you can get that exposure model wrong and it really doesn't matter. When you get away from normality, and maybe you have, well, in particular, if you have a binary response, so what if you have a normal measurement model, a logistic regression model for the Y, for the outcome given the X, and a normal model for exposure, or maybe you replace the normal model for exposure with something more flexible. It's kind of a mixed bag in a sense, and there's some slightly contradictory stuff in the literature. Certainly whenever I try this, I tend to find that it doesn't matter. You can get the exposure model wrong, and things don't change, or you can put in some sort of flexible model, and in particular I have an example where you put in a flexible model for exposure that the inferences do suggest that the exposure is not normally distributed, but you get the same estimates of the parameters in the response model or the disease model that you had when you made the normality assumption. So my limited experience is that it doesn't matter very much, but then there's some other literature that says it does matter somewhat. So there's more work needed here, I guess, is about all I have to say today. But I would conjecture that some of the stuff that's trying to be totally non-parametric, I'm really not sure it's necessary. I think you can maybe at most a little flexibility beyond normal for these exposure models is probably all you'll ever need in any practical sense, because, you know, in some sense that exposure part of the model is somewhat separate or somewhat removed from the disease model or the outcome model that you're really interested in. So I think some of the stuff in the literature is maybe harping too much on this danger of using parametric models for exposure. So that's a little bit about this issue of parametricness. But what I really want to talk about is issues of identifiability. And I think this is really a particularly thorny issue in this measurement error world. Sometimes it's not an issue. Sometimes you've got a rich enough data structure that under plausible models, everything's identified. And in particular, the two common settings would be that if you really had replicates of this poorly measured surrogate for X, that is, if you've got W1 through WK, which are IID, given the true but unobserved X variable, then typically you're in business. You can learn enough about the structure of the measurement error to have an identified model overall. Or the other one is that in some cases you can measure X, it's just expensive, so you end up measuring X for a few subjects. So in particular for a validation substudy, you measure everything, the outcome, the other covariates, the true exposure, the noisy version of exposure, But then for the majority of the subjects, you wouldn't have the X. And again, then you're kind of in business on the identifiability front. But those settings really don't cover all the practical cases people are interested in. And in particular, if you talk to epidemiologists and the exposures they're interested in, and you know, exposures to ambient things in the air or exposures in terms of nutrients coming into the body and so on and so forth, basically, I don't think you ever have this. I don't think you ever have this in most of those problems. So I think it's a stretch to put everything into one of these two frameworks. So then that leads to a dilemma. You may really have to push your assumptions to get an identified model. So I'll call that making optimistic assumptions. And I'm being very generic and vague here, but you would either be optimistic about the data quality. So the extreme example is to say there's no problem. W is exactly the same as X. Exposure is measured fine. Let's proceed. And in fact, that's mostly what people do in practice. But similarly, you could say, well, I know there's a problem here. I know that W is only a noisy surrogate for X, but I'm going to assume a lot about this distribution, maybe more than I really know, in order to get an identified model. So that's the optimistic story, or the optimistic approach, I guess you could say. Or you could try and be more realistic and say, well, I don't really know so much about how this noisy surrogate W arises as a measurement for this X that I'm really interested in. So you make more realistic assumptions, but often that means you're not making strong enough assumptions to have a model that's identified. So there's the kind of stark dilemma. Which of those strategies are you going to pursue? And I'd call this a case of picking your poison. You're not going to end up with large sample consistent estimators either way. If you make your realistic assumptions, sure, you're going to have an identified model, but unless those assumptions are exactly right, your model's wrong, and you'll pay a biased price for that. Estimates will be biased because you've got a misspecified model. If you make the realistic assumptions and you're stuck with an unidentified model, well, for us Bayesians, that doesn't mean we can't do inference. We can still turn the Bayes MCMC crank, but presumably we'll pay some price for that, and that's exactly what I want to talk about, that you'll incur a bias that way as well. So pick your bias. That's basically the story. In many of these problems, I don't think you really do know enough to have identifiability. Well, if you force identifiability, it's at the cost of model misspecification. So either way, you're not going to get some of the nice statistical properties that you like estimators to have. But we can, at least we can compare. We've got two different approaches. They're going to lead to two different biases. At least we can compare those biases. The model misspecification bias, well, that's sort of well understood, I think, in a sense. Sometimes it's kind of obvious what that bias will be, or there's theory if it's not so obvious, right? I mean, there's theory about what happens to ML or Bayes estimators if you're fitting a model that's not right. So there's the paper by White, for instance, which is often cited in that regard. In particular, I guess, let me back up a minute. I'm thinking that there's some pesky parameter, or maybe more than one pesky parameter here, that I'll call a bias parameter. And this is the one that we either have to be optimistic or realistic about. And so without loss of generality, let's say that zero is the optimistic value, right? So if you're really stretching your assumptions to get an identified model, you're setting B equal to zero. If you're being more realistic, you say, well, I think B might be sort of close to zero, but, you know, I'm not convinced it's exactly zero. So on the Bayesian side, then, okay, let's put a prior on that thing. We'll center it at zero, because that's maybe our kind of hope or best guess, but we'll put in some quote-unquote small variance to recognize the fact that we don't know that thing exactly. It turns out when you do turn the Bayes MCMC crank, you can work out that what the bias you'll incur will be just because of the fact that your model is not identified. At least in some problems, it's relatively easy to get a handle on this. Now, of course, this is really only on the Bayesian side, right, because you can't do this on the non-Bayesian or the likelihood side, right? I mean, there's you're making a sort of close to or nearly assumption, right? I think B is around zero. So that's kind of pushing you in the Bayesian camp, whether you like it or not. Okay, so the issue. So this. I'm not going to go through this in great detail, but the point is that you can work out what the bias price you're going to pay is because your model is not fully identified, because you've said B is close to zero instead of saying B is equal to zero. And I guess that the point I want to stress, though, and I'll try and pick it out here, is that the fact that the model is not identified doesn't necessarily mean that inference is hopeless. And in particular, if you reparameterize the problem so that it's clear what you learn from the likelihood, so you reparameterize to this guy so that this first part, phi sub I, is the stuff that is appearing in the likelihood, and this second part, the phi sub n, is the stuff that isn't appearing in the likelihood, well, then you can kind of see exactly what you can learn. But the funny thing is that in many of these kinds of problems, when you do that, it's not the most obvious or natural parameterization, and in fact, often whatever prior distribution you start with in the original parameterization will lead you to a prior where these things are pretty dependent. And sometimes it's not even really a case of the prior per se. Sometimes the support of this guy depends on this guy. So we'll see an example of that later. And if that's true, even if this guy, the phi sub n, isn't in the likelihood, you're going to learn something indirectly about it by learning about phi sub I from the likelihood, right? There's some sort of bound in the parameter space or bounds in the parameter space which contains some information then about phi sub n. So inference isn't necessarily hopeless, even though formally the model's not identified. And so in particular, you can work out what exactly the bias price you're going to pay is if you're interested in g of phi as the parameter of interest, but your estimate is going to converge to this thing, some function of phi sub I, and that function will depend on what prior distribution you're starting with. So we can work it out. We can say what's the bias price we pay for trying to be realistic rather than optimistic, and then we go back and compare that to the bias price we pay for being optimistic and getting the model wrong. So here's an example, and we'll make things ridiculously parametric to help us state the case here. So we've got, remember, W is our noisy measurement or surrogate for the X that we'd like to see, and we're just going to assume that we're getting a W that's X plus noise. So it doesn't actually depend on the Y and the S. That's the so-called non-differential measurement error assumption, which is often made. Not always well supported, but often made. We've got just a simple linear regression model for the outcome, given the X, given the exposure, if you like, and some other covariate. And then we've got a normal model for this exposure. So remember, this is the one that some people don't like to have a model for, but we're sticking one in there. And, well, if you quickly count up the parameters here, I think you'll find there are eight. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. So there are eight parameters. But now our life, of course, is complicated by the fact that we're not going to observe the X, right? That's our whole problem. So we're going to see the W, the Y, and the S. And you can kind of see, well, everything is normal and linear here, so you're going to get a nice linear, normal linear model for the things you do see as well. So this is, you know, really simple example in some sense. And sure enough, you've got a jointly normal model for W and Y, which are given S with a mean structure that's linear in S. But we've lost a parameter along the way here, right? So now we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 parameters. This one has to be the same as this one. So there's our identifiability problem. We have eight unknown parameters floating around. We've got a data structure. Because we don't get to see the X, we've got a data structure which can, at best, identify seven parameters for us. So how are we going to break that? Well, I mean, as I talked about, there may be other data that can help us break this problem. Or one kind of curious approach is to say, well, maybe this S, this other covariate that's floating around, has some special properties. And this is the so-called trying to find an S, which is a so-called instrumental variable. So let's talk a little bit about that. So say this S isn't just any old covariate. Say it was selected very purposefully because it was believed to have these two properties, that it's associated with the X, but that it's conditionally independent of the outcome Y given X. So it's like sort of it's almost like another surrogate. We've already got W, right? W is a noisy version of X. So this is like saying, well, S is also somehow a noisy version of X with this special property that S is not driving the outcome. If you know X, it's X that's driving the outcome. And these two assumptions are what goes into calling S an instrumental variable. And of course, that instrumental variables are very much more widespread than just measurement error problems. Econometricians use them to deal with unobserved confounding, and there's a whole big literature on them, most of which is inaccessible to me, but that's another story. But anyway, if you really felt these assumptions were true, then you're back in business, because saying that S and X are conditionally independent, sorry, S and Y are conditionally independent given X, is saying that this coefficient is known to be zero in here. So we've solved our problem of having too many parameters. So in particular, in our reparameterized world, we can estimate those seven parameters from the data, and that's consistent estimation. As the sample size goes up, we'll get those right. We're taking the other parameter as known, which is true if these assumptions are exactly right. So fine, we're back to regular old parametric consistent inference. However, the devil's in the details here. Hard to verify this assumption is true, in part because you never get to see the X. And so when these kinds of things get used in practice, it's, I think, basically in the hope that you've picked an S which has these properties. So here's an example context from a recent paper on using instrumental variables in a measurement error modeling context. So it's a case control study. It's actually a binary Y, so it doesn't fit the framework we're talking about right now, but there's an interest in whether there's an association between arsenic concentration in people's tap water and a particular kind of cancer. You can't measure this X. You can you can make a lab measurement, but it's got error in it, so you get to see a W that's a noisy version of X. But in this particular example, they also went and they took toenail samples from the subjects and they measured arsenic concentration in those. And this is taken to be the instrumental variable. Well, you can imagine it satisfies the first property, it'll be associated with X, right? Presumably if there's more arsenic in your tap water, there's more arsenic in your toenail. But whether it has that key conditional independence property that it's not driving the outcome, that given X, Y, and S are independent, well, it sounds sort of plausible, but you don't know, right? And you'll never know in some sense. So it's a bit it's a bit worrisome. So whereas you might be optimistic and say, yes, that assumption's fine, and we'll call that the exact instrument assumption, and we're taking that parameter then as fixed and known. If we try and be more realistic, you say, well, maybe S is close to having that conditional independence property. Maybe that parameter is close to zero. So we'll call that the approximate instrument assumption, and we'll put a somewhat tight prior distribution on beta 3 centered at zero. Okay, so here's a specific example of this optimistic versus realistic assumption business. Question? Well, you wouldn't have to do that, but the idea is that you think that assumption is about right, and if it's violated, you're probably not sure whether it's violated to the left or to the right. Now, well, I mean, in a subject area context, you might have. It's a good question. I mean, this is maybe not the most realistic prior, but it's probably more realistic than the point mass prior at zero. So that's another way to think about it, is that these are two different priors, right? This is a point mass. This is centered at zero, but it's at least got some width to say maybe that assumption's not quite right. But we do pay this price I talked about earlier. If we make that assumption, beta 3, we have some sort of soft constraint on it, but it's unknown, and we're back to having too many parameters. So we're back to losing our nice property of identifiability and consistency. Is that fatal? Well, I'm going to show you some pictures in a second to try and convince you that it's not necessarily that's not necessarily a fatal flaw. It turns out that this is one of these problems whereby there's kind of an inherent bound in the parameter space, and that pesky parameter, that beta 3, or equivalently that phi 3 in our reparameterized version, its support does depend on the other parameters, and you are learning those other parameters from the data. So there's a truncation here. So this is not purely Bayesian in some sense, or it's, the information is not purely coming from prior specification. There's a hard bound in the parameter space that is giving some, if not most, of that learning. So the pictures we see are going to compare the prior distribution we start with on that beta 3 or that phi 3, this pesky parameter, to what we would see in the large sample limit. The limiting posterior distribution, if you like. Now, the limiting posterior distribution is not a point mass, because we're out of our nice world where we've got identified models and consistent estimation of everything. But the point is that this thing can be rather concentrated relative to the prior you started with. That is to say, you can learn about 7 of those 8 parameters perfectly from the data, and you learn something about the 8th one. You don't learn everything, but you don't learn nothing. You're somewhere in between. So here are the sorts of pictures we see. And there are multiple pictures because it turns out that how much you learn about that parameter depends very much on where you are in the parameter space. So these are just different points in the parameter space in the different panels here, if you like. So for instance, in this particular point in the parameter space, you start with the red prior. In the large sample limit, you'll get this blue posterior. So you've learned something about that parameter, and the green point indicates the true value. So you've learned something, and you're sort of consistent with the true value. But that, in some sense, is one of the worst points in the parameter space. If you look at points like this, you're learning an awful lot about that parameter. And in some cases, it's almost like you're getting a point mass at the true value, which is kind of surprising. The other thing, I don't know how well it shows up here, but there's a shading here. There's a gray patch and a white patch and a gray patch again. So the gray patches are showing where the truncation is happening. So that the posterior, asymptotically anyway, the posterior can't be in those gray zones, and that's partly what's driving this concentration. I don't think it's showing up very well on the slide here. So the point is, again, we're in this funny world where we learn something, we don't learn everything. Here are just some more points in the parameter space, and it's kind of irregular. It's very volatile. You move around the parameter space, and you learn more or less about this parameter. So it's kind of odd. And you're getting these are large sample limiting distributions, and they got kind of bizarre shapes, right? It's weird. But you're learning something, so maybe this lack of identifiability is not fatal. But the real issue is, let's compare to our other strategy. Let's compare to the strategy where we push the assumptions far enough to get an identified model and pay this price of bias because the model's wrong. So I guess I'm gonna try and tell the quick version of this story. Now, of course, we know if the assumption is right, if we make that exact instrumental variable assumption, and assuming beta 3 is 0, and it really is 0, then of course that's best, right? Then you're back to identifiability, large sample consistency, models right, and no problem. But if we get that assumption a bit wrong, we're going to pay some price of bias due to misspecification. And of course, we presumably will pay more of a price as that parameter, as the true value of that parameter deviates from zero. But in general, we've got these two biases. We want to compare across the parameter space which is worst. And in particular, I should say, we're talking about now inference about beta 2, which is the XY coefficient in the disease model or the response model. That's usually the thing we're interested in most, right? So I'm going to tell you the really quick version of this. The fact that more of these points are above the middle blue line than below is saying that in aggregate, this bias, from assuming it's an exact instrumental variable, is worse than this one, from assuming it's an approximate instrumental variable. And again, the fact that we've got multiple points is simply because we've got multiple places in the parameter space and things are very volatile over the parameter space. And the other thing that's going on, these are all plotted against true values of the parameters themselves to see if there's much systematic pattern here, but there isn't really. This picture is maybe a little bit more, a little easier to understand. This is now plotting that the ratio of the two biases as a function of that parameter. So that when that parameter really is zero, the bias ratio is zero. That is, you're not incurring any bias if you make that strong assumption. But as the true value deviates from zero, this thing shoots up very rapidly, typically, so that quickly you're above one. So the top of the blue bar here is one. And you're getting a bigger bias from that strong assumption than you get from the weaker assumption. And again, the reason that there are multiple curves here is that things change on depending on where you are in the parameter space. What are the values of all the other parameters? And then I think there's a... Oh, I think I'll skip that one. But the bottom line seems to be that this approximate assumption looks somewhat attractive in terms of bias unless you're really absolutely sure that assumption is correct, that the beta 3 is 0, that you've got a real exact instrumental variable. So in fact, it may sound like statistical heresy in a way, but you would prefer inferences from a non-identified but more realistic model to those from an identified but less realistic, i.e. misspecified model. And in fact, this is becoming a familiar refrain for a few researchers at least. I mean, in lots of kind of problems of this ilk, we tend to have this same sort of finding. Now, I think I'm almost out of time, right?
Yeah.
Oh, what time did we start?
10:40.
Okay. I'll make this version kind of quick as well. Now, we could switch over now to logistic regression and kind of ask the same question. So all I've changed here now, still things are highly parametric, probably unrealistically parametric, but now we're talking about a binary response instead of a continuous one. So we stick in a logistic regression model. And the funny thing that happens here is that in going from a normal linear model for a continuous outcome to a logistic model for a binary outcome, all of a sudden we solve our identifiability problem. Boom. These parameters are all formally identified. And I won't go into the technicalities of why that is, except to say you need to curb your enthusiasm. One of the parameters floating around, if you reparameterize to figure out what's going on here, one of the parameters floating around is governing the link function for the binary regression of... Now, this is now the binary regression of the y on the w, right? Because you don't actually see the x. So now you have a model for y given w. Don't worry about all this, but look at this picture. Here are three different values of that parameter and the corresponding three different... These are inverse link functions, I guess, because they're plotting probability as a function of a linear predictor. So there are three curves there, right? There's a blue one, a red one, and a green one. But if you've done much binary regression, you're probably thinking, well, I might need a lot of data to pick out which of these ones is right and which are wrong empirically, right? I mean, you know, standard textbook example is, you know, you can fit a logit model and a probit model and sort of the same in many circumstances, right? Well, look how close these things are. And these are actually, in some sense, spanning a huge range of the parameter space, yet they're this close together. So if you like, there's going to be, if you could write, it's not closed form, but if you could write down an information matrix for this model, it's going to have some tiny, one of the diagonal elements is going to be tiny, basically. Question? Sure. So you're starting out, you've got, again, W is just a noisy surrogate for X. You've got a logit model for Y given X and this other covariate, and then a normal model for the X itself. And now I'm not making any assumptions about the S. I'm not,